Coming up on Tech News Today, Uber's class action ruling means its drivers are still contractors and not employees. Apple hits a speed bump in China. Plastic bags make good drone lookalikes. AMD earnings hint at upcoming console releases that are as yet unannounced. And robots may be more artistic than you. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1498, recorded Friday, April 22nd, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescription.
And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about what's happening in technology today. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes you just got to get down to it, you know?
Yeah. You
Friday.
Are. You really.
It's Friday. Sorry.
It is Friday.
I've got the neck thing. Sometimes I can't help it. Sorry. I hope I didn't scare away our guest, Selena Larson of the Daily Dot. How's it going, Selena?
Well, now it's going really well.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you're just feeling it, you know? You just got to get down.
Yeah, yeah.
With your bad self.
Sometimes.
Sorry. Sorry I did that.
You can't
how are you, Selena?
It.
It's really good to have you back.
I'm not as good as you are, apparently. But yeah, great to be here. Thanks so much for having me again.
It's always a pleasure getting you on the show.
All right, well, let's talk about the news. There's big Uber news today. The ride-hailing company will pay $100 million to settle a class action lawsuit brought against them by some drivers in California and Massachusetts. Now, $100 million sounds absolutely great, but
it
is
does.
This...
I'll take some of that. Oh.
But is this the case of winning the battle and actually losing the war? I know you wrote about this on the Daily Dot, Selena. What do you think?
So it's important to note that Uber will pay $84 million to the plaintiffs, and then there will be a second payment of $16 million if Uber goes public and the valuation increases 1.5 times from the December 2015 financing valuation in the first year of the IPO. So it's up to $100 million. I mean, it's still a lot of money. But basically what this means is just like it. So you know, there's this whole ongoing debate over whether drivers are employees or they're simply contract workers that would not get the benefits of being an employee of a company. So the fact that they have reached a settlement and drivers are going to continue to be freelancers at least with these two lawsuits in California and Massachusetts is kind of a big deal. I mean, it really just goes to Uber's, you know, entire business model. They can like maintain having drivers as freelancing contract workers and not have them designated as employees.
It's such an interesting case. I mean, you know, we were just in Las Vegas at a convention, so we took a lot of Ubers and Lyfts. And, like, by and large, whoever you talk to, you know, whatever drivers you talk to, and they work for the company and represent the company, they will say, like, I love the flexibility. This is a great job. It's wonderful. But then we also had a fan who's been a longtime cab driver in Las Vegas, and he hates it. And he said, this is my full-time job. And I don't have, you know, I have benefits. I don't have to drive my own car, which is great. And Uber and Lyft is coming in and messing everything up. So, you know, I go back and forth. And interestingly enough, too, I've had really no problems with Lyft or Uber in San Francisco or DC or San Diego. But in Las Vegas, they make it very difficult because they're set up for tourists. Mm-hmm. And, there's lots of people going from hotel to casino in cabs. And so several times the people outside of the hotel told Jason and I, oh, yeah, you pick up your Lyft that way. And it was exactly the
wrong way. Pretty much they
the
just pointed
way.
To the door that you go through and then you get lost in the casino trying to find the place. It's obvious that a city like Vegas is set up for cabs and has been for such a long time. So, mm-hmm. you know, they see it as kind of like an intruder of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you kind of get that everywhere, right? And not just on the, not just like, you know, employees having benefits and, you know, like having a car, but there's also a lot of like different regulations. And when you're getting, you know, your license to become a taxi driver, it's a lot more stringent. There's a lot more things that you have to do, more rigorous background checks. You have to go to classes. A lot of cabs consider themselves cab drivers to sort of be ambassadors to the city and know every single nook and cranny. Whereas oftentimes, the last few times, in fact, I've taken a Lyft here in San Francisco, you know, the drivers will be like, oh, I live in Sacramento. I come down here because I make money. I don't, you know, I'm not super familiar with the city. I'm using Waze. So you have all of these sort of, you know, the benefits that come with being a licensed taxi driver and working for a company like that is not just, you know, the contract versus employee thing, but there's a lot of more like nuanced arguments that go into it. Along with the settlement too, Uber's kind of relaxing or making some concessions over how it treats its drivers. And that includes providing them with more information of their individual rating, which, you know, was a lot of times held very close to the vest. They didn't necessarily get an explanation when they were kicked off of the service. There's new policy explaining why Uber will, you know, deactivate different accounts, and they're considering having having drivers petition them to like be back and to drive again. And then also another thing that I thought was pretty interesting was they're gonna work to create a drivers association, basically have like a representative, like elected representation for the drivers. So they can, you know, work with management, but it's very important to know that it's not, they won't have the ability to like collectively bargain or unionize.
I think one interesting thing here, and it touches on our experience in Vegas over the last couple of days, is, you know, we ended up using Lyft probably a lot more than Uber. And I'm sure it depends region by region, which service is stronger, you know, for an area. I just personally enjoyed the Lyft experience there. One thing I really liked about Lyft is that you can tip inside the app. Mm-hmm. You're done. Mm-hmm. You drop a $2, $5 tip, whatever, you know, based on your driving. You can't do that in the Uber app. Part of the settlement actually enables, Uber says that drivers can now ask for tips. So in this case, one of the things that I really enjoy about the kind of ride sharing thing is that you don't ever have to touch your cash, right? It's kind of one of those kind of pesky situations in a cab experience that you no longer have to do. You do it inside the app. Kind of sounds like probably going to start hearing from Uber drivers, I would imagine, at least having some sort of mention that they're able to take tips. It's not possible inside the app. I don't know.
Well, it's not possible yet. Are they saying they're going to put it in the app or not?
They didn't mention, as far as I can tell, they didn't mention anything about putting it in the app. They're just saying you can start asking for tips.
Yeah.
They should put it in the app, though. Much better that way.
Also, that for them, too. I mean, that was the thing that we talked about. Several of the drivers said, I feel safer not carrying around money. I mean, that is the thing. It's a benefit to being an Uber or Lyft driver as opposed to being a cab driver. You know, we had a driver who had been a cab driver for a long time, had been robbed, and that was no longer a risk anymore because he said some people still don't know that, they just don't understand that Uber and Lyft don't drive around with cash. And if, you know, if they're going to start taking tips, that's not going to be a benefit anymore either. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. And I think I was talking to someone else about this and they said, oh, I just assumed that Uber included the tip, that they pay more to their employees than Lyft does. But I don't think that's necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know a lot of people, especially in the very beginning, like you didn't even know, like you just kind of assumed that there was no tip. Like people are like, oh no, it's like included in the fee. Like you don't have to tip. It's not a thing. Which, you know, was pretty interesting. So I'm glad that Uber added that concession, but still, yes, I do think it should definitely be in the app.
And by the way, before we move on, we also had plenty of drivers who were both Lyft and Uber. And in some cases, when they were scheduled or, you know, about to accept an Uber pickup, when they noticed that we were there with Lyft, they canceled the Uber thing and came over to Lyft. I'm thinking maybe tip might have something to do with it. So there you go. Hey, tips. Yeah, or the powerful thing.
The percentage that they get paid by the company.
Or the percentage that they get, of course.
I mean, that would, I mean, they said, the Uber drivers said, oh, we get paid the same, but either way. But yeah, it would lead you to believe if they canceled the Uber and then, you know, picked us up instead.
Some sort of benefit there. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so moving on. Apple has long enjoyed relative peace when it comes to running its business inside China. It's a luxury that a number of other American-based tech companies have not experienced since the country named them as companies that operated too closely to official U.S. channels. Now, obviously, China can be very controlling and influential when it feels that it needs to be. And according to sources to the New York Times, Apple's free-ish ride appears to be ending. Apple's iBook store and iTunes Movies, that's two services that Apple launched in China some 6 months ago, have been shut down as demanded to do so by a Chinese regulator. It's the state administrator of press, publication, radio, film, and television, basically forced the closings. And in this case, both services directly basically compete with offerings inside China. By the way, Apple Pay has been cleared in China and directly competes with other mobile payments services from Alibaba and Tencent. So the, you know, the big question here is, has Apple's kind of fortune inside of China, operating its business with relative kind of, you know, freedom, as it were, is that slowing? Is that changing now? What do you guys think?
Well, I think it's interesting. It's only been 6 months, and it's actual content. You know, I think part of the reason that Apple has done so well in China is it's hardware, whereas Google is information, and China wants to control information. They want it to come from them. And so I think Apple gets away with a lot, but iBooks and iTunes, that doesn't really surprise me. But it's chilling as well, because I wonder if this is the first step to something larger. What do you think, Selena?
Well, also, too, both of these services are, like, really integral to the Apple experience, right? Like, it comes automatically with the hardware. You, like, Apple, right, they have all of these apps and services that are meant to work with each other, with the software, with the hardware. It could potentially, I don't know, impede growth if you're not, you know, able to use the whole package of Apple. You know, when you buy a device, you buy into all of it. So as you were saying, if they're, you know, kind of clamping down on that information, I wonder if that'll also impact more of the hardware aspect of things too.
Yeah, and that's a big, big consideration when you're talking about iOS. Like you say, that integration is so integral to that experience. It's all kind of, you know, looped in so tightly together. Apple considers China its second largest market. I mean, there's no denying it. China is an insanely large market. That size for any OEM, you know, they stand to benefit a lot just by offering their services, offering their hardware. They've seen an explosion of hardware, you know, inside China, just based on sheer numbers alone. And by the way, Foxconn, of course, manufactures iPhones and iPads, you know, does a lot of manufacturing for Apple. So Apple, you know, that kind of cooperation is very, very important to them. At the same time, I wonder if at a certain point, I mean, Apple, the most valuable company in the world, I mean, maybe they can stand to move manufacturing out of China if they need to. I mean, of any company, I'm sure they could probably pull that off if they really needed to.
I don't know. I mean, I know they can't afford to not sell iPhones in China. I mean, they can't. I mean, that's too big of a market. But I think it's fascinating in light of what we were talking about yesterday with the VPN, the free VPN. I mean, that is how people access content in China, through VPNs. So maybe that is the future, you know, people just including VPNs in the browser as Opera does. So that's one thing. But I don't know. I have to think that Apple's fight with the FBI, such a public fight with the FBI over encryption, is not endearing them to the Chinese at all.
That's a really good point. I mean, we don't necessarily know if this is because of that, but this is the kind of thing that will likely happen if that were to happen. And, you know, that's a big, big consideration that was being thrown around, is kind of like the global financial implication of knowing that there's insecurity built into these American devices, you know, American-made devices. So,
Well, a few days ago, Jason, you pointed out how disingenuous Google had been in supporting the government's antitrust case against Microsoft. Now that they are facing their own case in the EU, right. I guess they were listening to you because today they heard you. They're like, well, Jason Howell thinks we should get along. Then we should get along. Google and Microsoft have decided to drop regulatory complaints against each other. That's a report from Ina Fried from Recode. Now, I am wondering, do we think this is more of a sign of the changes in the industry as a whole? Or can we just say that Satya Nadella and Sundar Pichai are just more practical than the men they replaced? Of course, Steve Ballmer and Eric Schmidt. They also told Recode, quote, we will continue to focus on competing vigorously for business and for customers, which of course they would have to say.
Because they are competitors.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. There's still competition. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
What do you think, Selena?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it does have a lot to do with the leadership, I'm sure. You know, when you're talking about these two companies who are both dealing with, like, you know, similar regulatory issues, to kind of, you know, recognize that they're to kind of put the fisticuffs down a little bit and focus on dealing with these things. So perhaps it has a little bit to do with leadership. But yeah, I'm not sure. What about you, Jason?
I think that the Android slogan, be together, not the same, totally applies here. And by same, I mean, you know, they're both jerks that won't get along. Now they can be together. And so maybe, you know, maybe they're kind of holding true to that. I don't know. I feel like right now, especially now, and it's a theme that keeps coming up on these shows, is that, you know, tech companies in general that have insane amounts of money have influence, right? But really, right now, tech companies hold so much influence. And we're seeing time and time again that when they band together, they're realizing that instead of being intensely, you know, anti anyone else but us, when they band their efforts together in certain ways, they can really influence and change very greatly, you know, make a great impact. So I don't know, maybe that's my rose tinted glasses view on this. I like to think that that's happening because I just kind of hate to see these big companies going after each other, you know, patent litigation, all this kind of stuff. Thankfully, a lot of this stuff is kind of easing a little bit, and they're realizing that they've got, you know, they stand to gain a lot by working with each other and kind of laying off because they've got bigger fish to fry. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that's what we're seeing here.
Well, they also said that they wanted to be judged on the quality of their products, not be fighting each other in the court, you know, to win by having the best software as opposed to, you know, just because they took someone to court and their lawyers were smarter. So a person familiar with the matter also told the Wall Street Journal that Pichai and Nadella agreed to talk to each other first before taking problems to regulators, which I think is interesting, but they didn't make any product commitments. Mm-hmm. I am a big fan of Satya Nadella, and I think I don't, you know, love Microsoft's products, but I do love their apps. Like, I think they've done a lot, especially on Android and iOS, and I know that he's behind that. So I really feel like he's done a lot to just open it up a little bit and just say, like, hey, like, maybe everybody's not going to use Windows Phone. Maybe we need to create apps for everyone. That's the next step. So,
I think the timing is very interesting here. We've got the EU going after Google, you know, for antitrust on Android. Back in 2013, do a little like way back in 2013, Microsoft told the EU to look into how Google bundles its apps and its services with Android. So, you know, they were a piece of the puzzle a few years ago at kind of kicking off that investigation. Right when it starts happening now, they kind of call a truce on this kind of stuff. So it's interesting that they kind of lined up so well.
They told Recode that the deal had been in the works for a long time.
No doubt. They've been in the works, and it's actually kind of a coincidence that they happen to be hitting at the same time. But still, nonetheless, very interesting. We talked earlier this week about the watershed moment that was the case of the British Airways jet versus a flying drone. While we don't have concrete evidence that it wasn't, in fact, a drone that slammed into the passenger jet, it now sounds like it could very well be a different story altogether. The impact happened at around 1,700 feet in the air, more than four times higher than the height limit for drones that's allowed by law. Further inspection of the plane showed there was no visible sign of impact at the point of collision. In fact, it was said that, quote, it's entirely possible that the item in question was nothing more than a plastic bag, dot, 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 or something, dot. So apparently we don't actually know what hit the plane. I imagine if, it could have very well been that plastic bag right there, Brian.
Well, I frequently confuse garbage with drones.
I know.
So, you know, it could be an honest mistake here. You know, jokes aside, it is kind of problematic, though, when everyone kind of freaks out about, you know, oh, drone hit plane. And, you know, when it totally goes viral and then you bring up all these issues about like regulation and everything. So, perhaps like the investigation into air garbage it should be a little more thorough before calling it a drone.
I think so let's see here. It was Transport Minister Robert Goodwill basically put the blame on the local police for tweeting out the report of the drone impact. He said no evidence actually supports the drone, and kind of dismissed a little bit how it was determined or how it ever even came out in the first place that it was possibly a drone. You know, he said, you know, these are pilots. They've got a million different things going on. It's often very difficult for them to know exactly what that was that slammed into the plane. So,
right. And all the headlines said it might have been like, you know, a drone.
We never knew for sure.
Right. I never believed it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You can watch the show from I Never Believed It. I said that. Okay, so Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt. I usually listen to it the next day. It's a similar show to ours, so I wait so I'm not influenced. But he did actually report on this. They reported on this yesterday, so this is where I'm getting this information. But Tom says that Robert Goodwill is supportive of UAVs. Like, he's a known supporter of drones. And that they also made the point that, you know, pilots have to report whatever obviously is going to run into them. And like you said, they're looking at a lot, and that it was, it was the police's fault for tweeting it out and the rest of the journalists.
I blame Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
For being such an easy platform to send out, derogatory things against drones. Yeah. Don't do that.
But it is good that the transport minister is in support of thinks the drone rules are fine.
Yeah. He says there doesn't need to be tighter regulations on drones. This is good enough. By the way, the height limit for drones is 400 feet in the air. So,
flying like 1,700.
I know. Like, if that was a drone, that was like a lost drone. Like, no, come back. Oh, man, that just happen?
Yeah. But, Selena, I think, especially now that you have a public Snapchat, I think that if you can make air garbage a headline that someone wants to use and tweet everywhere, like, that's what I would like to see.
Or maybe a show title.
Yeah, maybe.
We'll see.
Well, up next, AMD earnings call hints at three new upcoming gaming systems. PlayStation, Nintendo, we know about, but what's the third? You can find out, maybe. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. Now, the pharmacy used to be the center of town, the place to catch up on the gossip, a spot where everybody
the water cooler.
The water cooler of town. Mm. Everybody knew your name, but then the giant corporations came in, and now it's just a place to go to stand in long lines and get other people's germs. But what if you could skip that trip to the pharmacy altogether? There's one transformative piece of technology that can do that, and it can make your life easier. It's PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that will make you wonder why you've ever settled for the traditional pharmacy. PillPack delivers your medications and vitamins in pre-sorted, easy-to-tear packets with labels containing the date and time for each dose, so you can get rid of that antiquated Monday-to-Sunday pill box. They use advanced technology to create personalized packets for each customer, and they're always checked by a pharmacist prior to being shipped. Pill packs go through an image recognition system that are built to ensure the right pill is in the right pack. The system can detect dispensing accuracy by size, shape, color, and density of each pill, and catalogs an image of every single packet dispensed. You can even order inhalers, creams, and diabetes supplies, and they come in refrigerated, easy-to-open packages. Switching is easy. You can sign up on their secure site, and they'll take care of everything for you. PillPack's pharmacists are available 24/7, so you can speak with them from the privacy of your own home or if you're on the go. They proactively contact your doctor to manage your refills so you never run out. It's compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D. There's no extra cost beyond your standard copays, and shipping is always free. And if you refer someone to PillPack and they sign up, PillPack will donate $100 to RX Art, a nonprofit organization whose mission is helping children heal through the extraordinary power of visual art. PillPack has a medication reminder app for the iPhone and for your Apple Watch. So why continue to endure your existing germy pharmacy? PillPack will not only bring your pharmacy into the digital age, but they will make your life much easier. Visit pillpack.com/twit to sign up now. It only takes about 5 minutes to sign up. When you use our link and transfer your prescriptions to PillPack, you will get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and OTCs. That's pillpack.com/TWIT.
All right. It's that time. How's it going, Sam?
Buddy, I am calling you from my new Surface Pro 4. Ooh. So consider how my video performance turns out, either an endorsement or a great condemnation of my brand new fancy tech. But I do feel like I'm already sharper in pixels. Yeah. So thank you so much, Surface Pro.
Yeah, I would say so. It actually looks pretty darn sharp. It's looking good.
I think Satya Nadella.
Yeah, personally. We'll call him up after the show.
Definitely bringing up the mustache pixelation.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Totally.
I've never seen your mustache with such clarity. Okay, so first things first, AMD had its earnings call yesterday. Some hints were dropped that seemed to point to upcoming gaming consoles. You read the tea leaves yourself. What did you find out, Sam?
I did. It was an interesting call because these sort of corporate financial earnings reports are typically vague. AMD wants to sound like they're going to make as much money as humanly possible without necessarily spoiling everything. But they made it clear that they got three SoC wins, meaning that three different orders for semi-custom parts have gone all the way through. They're going to start production, and that's going to beef up revenue starting in the second quarter, which means those things are coming. They went on to say that the hardware, at least one of these semi-custom chips, is going to launch in the second half of this year. Not all three of these wins are going to launch in 2016. But for that revenue to kick in right now, and for them to specifically say these were about gaming something to do with gaming, but a semi-custom chip is typically the kind of thing you're going to find in a gaming system. So it leads us to believe that we know for sure that Sony is going to be involved with one of these, because the leaks have been huge for their PlayStation 4.5, PlayStation Neo, PlayStation 4K, whatever you want to call it. Sony is full steam ahead with developers telling them that a semi-new PlayStation 4 is going to come out, possibly with 4K video support, certainly with beefier graphics and chips. So we know AMD has that in the bag, which leaves us wondering, what are the other two? Now, we do also know Nintendo's been very clear that something called Nintendo NX, that's the code name for now, that is going to launch. Assumedly this year, they could certainly change their mind, but they've been very forward with investors that that's going to happen. And though AMD made a chip for the Wii U, that was the graphics chip, not the processor. Now, a semi-custom full solution would be the perfect thing for both the graphics and the CPU. So that certainly makes sense, especially since IBM, who did the Wii U CPU, they're not doing game processors processors anymore. So that leads us to believe that it's very likely that the second one of these is a Nintendo chip. The question is, what's the third now? And that could be anything. Now, Nintendo had already said, some leaks had indicated that this little, the new Nintendo system is going to have a controller that may very well have its own processor in it. But we don't know. We don't know if it's going to be like you see on the screen, this sort of crazy touchscreen controller, or if it's going to be something else entirely. The patents tend to leave all kinds of red herrings out there in the tech wild. It may not very well have its own chip at all. That might have also been a red herring, that it's just a dumb controller that just syncs up to a main console in your house, which then leaves us with maybe it's Microsoft who's going to have a refreshed video game system that comes out, because they have talked kind of sort of about the idea of Xbox sort of living and breathing and adapting, and that the idea is that your game system can grow and change over time. So we could see an Xbox 1.5 come out by the middle of next year based on these projections. We really don't know, but we do know AMD was clear that these are about gaming. These are going to push, these three semi-custom chips are going to push $1.5 billion in revenue. And that number got stockholders very excited. That got the stock price jumping up immediately yesterday. And we do know that the one thing that the CEO of AMD indicated was that these are not for quote-unquote same systems. These are for updated, quote-unquote, brand new systems, which I believe the PlayStation 4.5 would qualify as. So these chips aren't going to go into, for example, an Xbox Slim or a PlayStation Slim, where they take the old system and just shrink it down sort of as a way to drive new shoppers to something that's been out for a while. So it's more questions than answers, but it's certainly interesting, and I think we're going to have a lot of information coming at us when E3, the big Electronic Entertainment Expo, hits this June. And I will be there, and I will be very excited to see what the heck is going on and how much AMD is involved with it.
I'm holding out for a new ColecoVision. It's just me.
What do you want to see?
I think, I really want to see Nintendo finally get a system that is on par, because that's at this point, there's just very little reason for Nintendo to release a system that has some sort of crazy underpowered chip. Everybody's sort of on the x86 bandwagon in terms of how they're designing games. So if I'm a game developer, I want something that's relatively easy to get on. And then on top of that, Nintendo can perhaps offer some sort of enhanced or weird control. Don't make it hard to program. Make it interesting for me as a game maker in terms of controls or in terms of certain functionality. You know, as long as they can get the processor stuff sort of straight, that's really what I hope for. Beyond that, there's been a lot of rumblings from game developers about the fact that having to make essentially two kinds of PlayStation 4 games might be a pain in the butt. Sony may be shooting themselves in the foot with a PlayStation 4 and a PlayStation 4.5. If I'm a game maker and I essentially have to build two copies of a game just to run on Sony's platform in general, that sounds like a pain in the butt. People really were happy with PlayStation 4 being easier to develop for this time around, because PlayStation 3 was famous for being a pain in the butt to code on. So This could be a really big backward step for them. It remains to be seen what really they have going on. Because again, we're only talking about leaked information. Nobody's come out and said anything official. This could all get spun around if something just doesn't happen to come out in the end. So a lot remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, videogamer.com said today that there's some titles that you can only buy if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber. You dug into this. What can you tell us about this story?
Now, Amazon has been doing something a little weird for, I guess, the past calendar year, where sometimes they'll have a flash sale that says Amazon Prime only. And you might think to yourself, oh, well, if I'm not an Amazon Prime subscriber, if I'm not paying that $99 a year or £79 a year if you're in the UK, I just don't get that nice price. I would still have to pay the normal price. Well, what happens is they're saying, no, you can't get this specific product from us directly at Amazon at all unless you're a Prime subscriber. This has been rolling out in bits and pieces for different sort of products. There were some, I remember seeing this just because I was looking for a Beach Boys album last year, and there was one that was, I want to say it was a vinyl one that was Amazon Prime only. You couldn't get it unless you were a Prime subscriber. So what happened was today in the UK, five games got flash sales that were all attached to this Amazon Prime rule. And then in the United States, it sounds like at least Grand Theft Auto 5 for some time was also hit with this, as was, it turns out I've checked later, Fallout 4's computer version may have also been hit that way. That has changed. I think that since the article went live, they've changed this stuff. This is all dynamic. But essentially, Amazon's making it really clear they can do what they want. They can say, you know what? You got to be Amazon Prime. Too bad. So sad if you're not. And even then, it's really hard to create a hubbub, because right next to that official Amazon listing is, you know, 30 resellers that are Amazon affiliated. You know, here's one of our trusted resellers with a new copy or a used copy. And some of that has Prime shipping and some of it doesn't, and blah, blah, blah. It just seems like it's another chance for Amazon to essentially say, we can do whatever we want with Prime. We're going to stop doing things that are just about adding value. And now we're taking away value if you're not a Prime subscriber. Because again, this little specific thing about Prime sales is not listed on their fancy giant list of here's what Prime gets you. They're not really doing a good job of communicating to customers, hey, being a Prime subscriber means you're screwed a tiny bit less. So I could really stand to use some information cleanup on their part. But you know, at this point, it's a weird move on Amazon's part, but sadly, it's not really shocking.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not like you couldn't get that Beach Boys album anywhere, or you couldn't get that Grand Theft Auto anywhere. You just couldn't buy it from Amazon unless you were a Prime.
Like the official Amazon offer.
Right. And that's the question is this going to happen in the future where they take specific items and say, oh, You got to be prime. You've got to be prime to buy this brand of laundry detergent. You have to be prime to get this special DLC of a video game. You know, this may be speaking to something that comes 1, 2, 5 years down the line. As far as you know, it's the Walmart effect. Once you're the only game in town, you can start being an 800-pound gorilla in these really anti-consumer ways. So definitely, this may be a bad tiding for future Amazon to come. But we'll keep our eyes on it.
It is interesting because I do think we just sort of at this point expect that from Amazon. You know, I mean, it's not like no one has the love that they have for Apple or Google or Microsoft that they do for Amazon. There's no one that's just, you know, I just love the company. I love Jeff Bezos.
Well, you're not sitting by the bed just caressing your Amazon Fire phone every night before you go to sleep.
Well, I do love my Amazon Echo. And I'm conflicted at times, but I did buy Prince's Let's Go Crazy last night with my voice for 69 cents and danced to it in my living room. And that was awesome, I have to say. Yep. But I couldn't have done that without being a Prime subscriber. Membership has its benefits, I guess.
Yeah, apparently. And I'm happy you didn't record that and upload it to YouTube.
I didn't record it and upload it. No.
Good move. Finally, we mentioned earlier this week on the show that Microsoft's immensely successful, to put it lightly, Xbox 360 was ending production. Sam, you wrote an article kind of looking back on its 10-year life, its history of hardware revisions. Is this proof that you have a bit of a soft spot for the Red Ring of Death?
Well, I was a victim of the Red Ring of Death. Soft spot means, you know, the tender hole it carved into my heart when I was a much poorer video game player about 8 years ago when that all went down. I think the Xbox 360 is very interesting in terms of having so many hardware revisions as a result of the Red Ring. The Red Ring really wreaked havoc, and it took Microsoft quite some time to dig themselves out of it. You know, we don't talk about that necessarily anymore. You don't have to check the serial code on the box that you buy for any Microsoft product these days to determine whether or not it's going to blow up in your house. But that was the case because it was their first motherboard, their second motherboard, and even to some extent a little bit of the third motherboard for the system were all affected by this thermal paste issue. It was huge. It cost them so much money. And the fact that Microsoft went to great lengths to remedy that, to make sure that everybody who was affected would not be completely burnt, would be able to get a replacement system, that was huge. That was such a huge move on their part, especially since the Xbox division has never been a moneymaker. It's always been a reputation builder. It's been the thing where people go, well, at least I like this about Microsoft consistently. And the 360 generation really cemented Microsoft's, it was the one division at Microsoft that didn't get bombered. You know, that you really got a solid product. It looked like the team knew what they were doing. They were putting together not only good hardware. I mean, the Xbox 360's architecture was very easy to make games on, which, you know, the PlayStation 3, as I said earlier, was not. So that gave them a good lead. They were very aggressive about building a working online gaming system that made people say, you know what, I am going to pay an annual fee to be connected to online gaming, which if you'd asked me that in 1999, if I would pay a monthly fee or a yearly fee to play online video games, I would have said, what? Because, you know, I'm a PC gamer at heart. But they really managed to build out a ton of features, a really great indie games curation. They actually, to some extent, were beating Steam in terms of putting out independent, digitally distributed games, which is saying something because Steam is currently the titan of that. But Xbox Live Arcade was so huge about that. So it is interesting to see the 360's hardware run end, also because it's not really dead. Phil Spencer, the chief of Xbox, made a really big deal at the end of February at a press event where he said he doesn't want people to have to give up their libraries. It's the end of a gaming generation has always been dump your old cartridges and your old games and buy the whole new stuff. It was the kind of thing that I remember drove my mom nuts when I reached out begging for a Super Nintendo. You already have a Nintendo, Sam. No, Mom, I need the Super one with the new games, etc. And now we're in an era where we sort of expect our software to come with us when we get new devices. When we get a new iPhone, a new Android phone, a new PC, we don't have to dump all of our software, all of the stuff that we've really grown attached to. And Xbox, with backwards compatibility and with some other strides I think they're going to be making for the Xbox line, are really interested in keeping you for life and saying, if you bought Super Meat Boy in the late 2000s, you should be able to continue playing that in 2022. That should continue to work. There's no reason not to. It's a simple piece of code that you love a lot, and we're going to keep you hooked as a gamer with services. If gaming is going to be the sort of subscription-based, device-agnostic kind of thing going forward, then Microsoft really has a chance right now to affirm itself as a kind of platform that you're going to stick with for a long time. So the 360 was the beginning of Microsoft getting some really big things right about home entertainment, about home device ownership. So I'm really hoping that their best lessons continue going forward throughout my gaming life.
And Microsoft didn't include a ring on the one to be infected by redness, right?
No, they
Learned that lesson, right? At least they kept the ring off there entirely.
No, they kept the ring off. I'm sure that there's some sort of terrifying light flash that will happen whenever it starts melting down. But right. I have mine set up in such a way that it has all of the cool air going around it just in case.
Excellent. Sam Moscovich, always a pleasure getting you on the show. Thanks for sharing your gaming amazingness with us. Tell people where they can follow all your work online.
So find me at Ars Technica. I just wrote a thing about a really terrible crime case that was busted in a very CSI way in terms of zoom and enhance. A guy actually did that with some old photos, and it's kind of a crazy story. And tomorrow I'm going to be at one of the most terrifying concerts I imagine I'll ever attend, Hatsune Miku. Have you ever heard of this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The Vocaloid tour is hitting the United States, and Seattle is the first United States stop, so I will be in either some sort of bright blue or bright pink wig while a hologram anime lady appears on, like, you know, 15 feet tall on a stage, and a giant heavy metal Japanese band is rocking behind her. I am terrified and excited about what's to come.
Oh, man, you have to write about that. I'm sure you're planning on writing about it, but I can't wait to read it.
Photos, please.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You got it.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, so I wanted you to come back so that you could join us in this story about how smart you are if you use the Chrome browser. We got an email. Rachel writes, while discussing the Google antitrust news this week, it was mentioned that people who are most successful use the Chrome browser. Can you please provide me with a link or more information about this? Thank you, Rachel. So the research for this came from a company called Cornerstone On Demand. They do workplace science. I heard about it, I'm pretty sure, on the TED Radio Hour, but it might have been the Freakonomics podcast. I have a lot of podcasts in my brain, and they roll around. But there's also an article in The Atlantic about this. It's really fascinating because, I mean, what you said, Jason, we were talking about this, it must be just some industries where you can say that you're a better employee if you use Chrome or Firefox. They did the study with customer service jobs in telecommunications, retail, and hospitality. But they said that the people who took this test with Chrome or Firefox were better employees. Have you heard about this, Selena?
I haven't, but I am a Chrome user, so I believe it.
Well, the idea is just that you don't settle for what the default is, that you're willing to look for something else, and then that might, you know, be a correlation in your job that you would work harder. And so, they stay in jobs 15% longer and performed better in the jobs. So.
You've made an active choice to do something that wasn't the default. Mm-hmm. From the Freakonomics radio show, anyways, that's what's in here. So, I believe it. I mean, again, I think it really applies to certain things, maybe more technical jobs than other types of jobs, I suppose. But yeah, I suppose I would believe that.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to use the McAfee antivirus that's built into your computer either.
Probably
there's a large crossover of people who install Chrome and people who try and get rid of the McAfee antivirus installed.
Versus the people that just suddenly pay for it for ages and have
years later that they're still paying for this thing and they don't even know what it does.
Mm-hmm.
All right, coming up, you may not have artistic talent, but your robot might. But before that, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. That's Epson. Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home, for office, introduces a new age in printing. You should definitely check it out. It's the new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer. Doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features a refillable ink tank that's just awesome. You can see it in use here. It comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That's equivalent to around 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded, you're ready to print for up to 2 years. It's actually powered by Epson's leading edge precision core technology, which delivers high speed, vivid colors, and laser quality black text. Plus, it has auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from your tablet or your smartphone. It's no wonder at all that the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value, ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles at the heart of that, and now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Super cool stuff. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today, and you can transform the way your home, your office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support. Epson, exceed your vision. All right, earlier this week, we talked about reusing old devices instead of throwing them away, and we asked you to email us about your old devices. Lots of you responded. Here's Robert Collins, who wrote, quote, "I use my old HTC One M7 as a media device to listen to music and watch podcasts such as, hey, what do you know, Tech News Today. There we are from NAB. It also sees reuse as a phone my niece and nephew can play on, so I still have my personal active Galaxy S7 Edge with me. In the picture, I'm watching and listening to TNT in the morning while at work fixing things." Excellent use of, these things. I remember, 5-7 years ago, to have like a personal media viewer, you would pay a couple hundred dollars for a single, use device that did just that. Mm-hmm. And now we have them once we upgrade our phone one time. We've got an extra one hanging around. So this is a great use for it. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Record a video, take a picture of yourself, your setup, post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it.
Well, let's say you want to show off your artistic skills and maybe win $100,000. You could if you're a robot. Selena, what can you tell us about this robot art competition that you reported on?
Yeah, so it's the first robot art competition. Essentially, an electrical engineer came, and he is also an oil painter and an artist himself, and he decided to create this competition where mostly school teams, but there are a couple of people who have entered who are not associated with university or high school to build a robot to create art, essentially. And there are two different categories. You have the fully automated, and then you have the manually generated. So fully automated naturally is it's completely done on software. It paints and dips it into the paint, and everything is done completely pre-programmed with no help from the person programs it, but no human component, and then you have the manually generated, which does have a human component, whether that's kind of moving things or programming every step of the way as you go. So it's pretty interesting, and there are 71 pieces of art, and you can check it out on robotart.org. And it's actually open for voting. There's a public voting component to this as well. So each team submitted, some teams submitted multiple art projects, but most of them, like I said, are affiliated with different universities, and they kind of just submitted these really fantastic contraptions. This year is focusing on the more technical aspect of things, but the creator told me that next year they're going to be really looking at sort of the artistic component for the judging. So it's pretty cool. The voting is open until May 15th. But what really interested me about this particular story is essentially when you have machines that are doing something so human, like creating art, you kind of have something similar with creating music or writing or you have these, artificial intelligence systems that can paint things that are very human and very, very touching and it's just this sort of element that isn't really a machine, Mm-hmm. And so I am always wondering, how do we put value on this? How do we judge something created by a robot versus created by a human? Can humans reach perfection? Can robots reach perfection? So this is kind of another step or another sort of, thought-provoking project that sort of like raises those questions and sort of encourages people to explore that. So that was why I was so excited about this. It's kind of neat.
Well, it's fascinating, too, because a human created the robot. A human helped create the AI. So, that's art in its own, I guess you could argue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A couple of things strike me about this, like as I'm kind of like looking over the art. Number one is when you
And I'm probably going to forget number two by the time I get there. So don't blame me if I only have one point, actually. But when you look at art, like looking at art, it's kind of what you were alluding to, Selena. It's kind of an emotional experience. Like you get an emotional response when you look at something that really resonates for you. And I kind of find it fascinating, like you were saying, Selena, how a robot can be something that has no, like there is no concept of emotion in a robot, more or less. Like that is a very human trait, human characteristic. Yet, let's say a robot or a computer could create something that is artistic that could still resonate in that way in a human. And then I can't remember if this was my second point, but it's a question that I have, so I'll pretend like it is. Is any of this generated completely? Like when we say AI, when I think AI, I think it starts, you know, the kind of brains behind it start in one way, and over time it learns to do new things that it wasn't originally programmed to do. Is any of this touching, like veering into that category? Like I could see 5 years down the line, computers actually creating from the ground up completely, like without any sort of true handholding or input from a human being in the form of coding, its own like original piece of art. Because a lot of this seems like it's based on something.
Yes. So for the projects, at least for the projects here, all the ones that I was looking at, they're all based off of an original piece of art, right? So you have like Andy Warhol, for example. There's a Marilyn Monroe painting that the robot is, you know, putting its own spin on and painting itself. So essentially, they're like programmed to learn these sort of art pieces and then recreate them in whatever way, you know, they decide, whether that's watercolor, acrylic, pointillism, any of these different ways of paint and content and structure and stuff. So so for this particular project, that's, you know, what, for the most part, what all of this is based on. There were some papers actually submitted with some of the entries that kind of went into a little bit about what you were talking about, kind of discussing how you program AI to learn to paint and create on its own. And so there are some of these universities who are obviously having they have like robotics programs are researching some stuff like that. I believe Georgia Tech was one that submitted something with a paper, as well as Carnegie Mellon University has a couple of submissions in there as well. So you can kind of see where people are definitely exploring that. This actually reminded me of a couple of projects. One, there was an artist I ran into at Autodesk here in San Francisco at one of their design nights, and he has built a robot to essentially read and recognize all of the photos on Instagram that were taken in a particular location, and then in paint, in black ink, print it or paint it out as you kind of go along. And so it's just like this one completely like extended photo gallery, I suppose. And all he has to do is like turn it on, and then the machine automatically like reads these photos, recognizes the location, and creates these kind of these pieces. And then there was this other study that was done that I linked to actually in my story back in last year. Actually, researchers discovered how to separate the content of an image from the style of an image. So essentially what ends up happening is computers can apply the style of Picasso or Rembrandt or anything, right, to any image. And they can kind of just create art that looks like it was created by these famous painters. And that kind of speaks to that as well. Like, oh, so art like these, like without human hand, without like humans, you know, doing anything besides reprogramming this computer, they can create art like the masters, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Selena, thank you so much. I love your pieces on the Daily Dot. I never know what to expect, and it's always an interesting side, really the human side of all the technology that we talk about every day. So is the best way to follow you at the Daily Dot? And Selena, you're Selena Larson on Twitter, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to shameless plug really fast, because when you were talking about Amazon and Echo, you totally reminded me. I also write fiction, and it's most of it has to do with tech and like how we interact with things and kind of the future. But this week's I Think You Would Like Megan. So I'm also on Medium, Selena Larson on Medium, if anyone is interested in reading tech fiction. So I just had to throw that out there. But yes.
I have read
Selena Larson on Twitter.
I have read some of your fiction on Medium. Like, do you do it every Friday? Do you post something, or Yes.
Yeah, it's every Friday.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I have read some of it, and it is great. She's right. I agree. And I had no idea.
Yeah. That is really cool. And, man, to write fiction and have, like, a weekly deadline for that, I applaud you. That's not easy.
The other thing that you've done that I have loved is one day you asked on Twitter for people to say a word that you would include in the fiction, and that was great. Have you done that more than once?
No, that was my first time. I've done it based off of tweets. I've done it. Today's was based off of a friend's suggestion because I went over to someone's house and they had like a little like an Echo, and so that's why it reminded me. You were talking about it, and okay. I was like, oh, you'll like this one. But
I will.
But yeah, I sometimes ask Twitter for inspiration. I should actually do that again. That was a good exercise.
Maybe you should ask the Amazon Echo for inspiration. Is that what you did? I guess I'll have to read it to find out.
Yeah, you'll have to find out.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Selena. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Right. Have a good weekend. All right, TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always be a part of the show. Just email us, tnt@twit.tv. Or you can leave us a short voicemail. It's 260-TNT-SHOW. And finally, we are there on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
Yeah, and we don't just sit. We listen to our voicemail. We love to get them. We had one at NAB that we played. And
yep.
So, yeah. Or send a video, too. Just take
love
a video, send
well.
It. We would love to see that. Yeah. And subscribe to our show if you don't already. That's twit.tv/TNT. And you can find me on Twitter at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett, and everyone. Every single person who helps us produce the show every single day. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all on Monday. Bye, everyone.